Man, Asian families are a nightmare. From grandmas to dads to fucking love. All of this on this episode of Fake Film Fans.
Hey everybody, welcome to Fake Film Fans. I'm Suede Best, your professional ghost cuckold.
Walter here. I'm a cell that is about to die, but our cell's even alive, so I guess I'm not even dead, right?
And me, I am Cheryl. I'm a professional mayonnaise wrestler, and I just woke up.
Yeah, congratulations.
Perfect.
So this is actually the first time Suede is meeting Cheryl too, and Cheryl is one of the few friends that I met through my brother now that I've been in HK, and that's pretty special because I have almost no friends in Hong Kong. Actually, so Cheryl, the reason why I wanted you on this podcast is besides the fact that you're funny and sad.
Thank you. I like
which
that.
Which is the perfect combination for this podcast.
I like that description.
Yeah, I don't think we've had anyone who's not funny and sad on this podcast, right? So, those are two criterias.
I mean, is Tori funny? I don't know if I'd call Tori funny.
Well, the other reason why, though, Cheryl, is because me and Suede are the biggest fucking clout chasers of all time.
We are clout chasers.
Clout.
I'm the Batman of clout chasing, and he's my boy Wonder, Robin of clout chasing. And you're our Joker.
I'm the Joker.
You could be Calendar Man if you want.
I didn't know Batman had a calendar man.
Yeah, calendar man. He's his whole thing is he's like obsessed with dates and times.
Are you serious? Is that a villain?
Yeah, that's literally his whole deal. He's just like obsessed with dates and times, and he does like holiday themed crimes. He'll be like, "Oh, it's Valentine's Day. I'll steal all the hearts from the transplant place."
That's so sad. That's so sad.
It is. It is sad.
I kind of relate to that, I guess.
I know, right? Do you live your life by the next holiday that's coming up?
I love holidays. I think I put a lot of emphasis on anything that can be symbolic. So like holidays are really important to me. And like if something doesn't meet the standard of what I imagine the holiday to be, I get so personally offended. So shit, I am telling
you. Okay, what holidays though?
Like Valentine's Day or Christmas. I mean,
okay.
Or New Year's. Everything just has so much weight, you know, like I'm the person that cannot unsee the black crow that I passed by.
Wait, does this also mean that your boyfriend will always have it rough on Valentine's Day?
I don't think my expectations are that big. Like, I'm not the kind of person that's like, I want like 100 roses. But I think I just would never be the person that doesn't expect birthdays or like other people's birthdays.
What is the most disappointing gift you've ever gotten for Valentine's or birthdays?
Well, there was a Valentine's Day in college. You know, I was really sweet and I baked someone that I was dating at the time peanut butter cookies that were gluten-free or something because he was gluten-free. And then he went to New York and he like didn't come back for like a week. And then, so this is pretty disappointing. It's not a gift that I received, but a gift that I gave.
And you should have known better because no one's actually gluten intolerant. No one, that's a lie. That's like not a thing. People, it's complete bullshit. It's for people who want to feel special. And more importantly, it's for people who want to make my life harder. Because when I'm grilling up, when I've got my grilled dad stuff going on, I've got my pickled vegetables, got my meat, got the rice, everything's ready, and then someone's like, oh, I can't eat gluten, I can't eat rice. They're just there to fuck up my day. It's fucking bullshit.
The funny thing about the story, one of Suede's really good friends, it has maggot worms in her body, so...
Ew, that's so gross.
She doesn't have maggot worms. She had Lyme's disease, and it's caused, she's doing great now, she's got a fantastic photography business, but she is a giant picky piece of shit and claims to be gluten intolerant, and I think it's just
maggots.
She's a pain in the ass.
It's the maggots.
I actually can't be too mean to her, though, because I want to bully her into letting me live in her upstairs of her house, because I'm tired of living in the upstairs of my parents' house.
Well, let me move on to why we're big clout chasers for Cheryl, for any of the listeners who don't know. Because according to your Wikipedia page, Cheryl, one day you said, Frank Ocean? Who? I will mush that tiny musician into a dead ant.
That's true.
I am the music queen. Music queen in all caps.
Excuse me, my Wikipedia.
So I have to ask, why do you hate Frank Ocean that much?
Wait, I've never said
that. I think I watched that interview. That's the one where you said, when Frank Ocean finally dies, I'm going to spit on his grave. I'm going to spit on it every day until his grave is just covered in muddy spit.
Okay, disclaimer to the audience, this is not true. This is all fake news, but I'll go along with it. No, I can't go along with it. I don't want to kill him. I love him. And I hope he's doing well, you know.
Walter and I would love to have you on the podcast. I couldn't even name a song that you've made.
And I'm on a first name basis with you, Frank. So, you know, you and me.
Frankie Frank.
That's true.
Thank you, Frank.
Gotta get him on the cast.
Fake Frank fans. Here we go.
My favorite song, Kiss Me Through the Phone.
Can you do a R&B rendition of that song?
Can you do a cappella?
Mm-hmm. It goes, baby, baby, I see your lips through the end of my phone. I want to kiss you, but I can't because it's just a song through the phone. Baby! Like that, right? Isn't that exactly how it goes, 100%?
It's exactly. It sounds just like the record.
I am Frank Ocean. You've actually never seen Frank Ocean before, but I am Frank Ocean.
Wow, you look, you know, a little different from the photos I have stuck up on my wall.
Yeah, a lot whiter, right? A lot whiter, a lot fatter.
A little bit.
So you mentioned holidays. Do you do any St. Patty's Day shenanigans?
I do not.
Are you like me who don't know anything about St. Patty's at all?
I know the booze. I know the clover. That's pretty much it. I mean, people celebrated St. Patty's Day in Boston. It was more like an excuse than a celebration, but
so Cheryl, you've pretty much summed up every person in downtown Roanoke, their relationship with St. Patty's Day. The first Saturday before St. Patrick's Day, everyone comes downtown in green shirts and fishnets, and there's a giant parade filled with giant horses, and then everyone goes to their respective bars and gets absolutely fucked up. And this is not like, oh, you know, they're like drunks out. This is like Mardi Gras for Roanoke for some reason. People are drunk in the streets. People are passed out in alleyways. There's always brawls. There's always fist fights. So we close the bookstore early the Saturday before St. Patty's Day because there's just no point in being open. Just because everyone's pissed drunk on the street. This year, I got to watch a father and son scream at each other for about 5 minutes about who was drunker and who was going to drive the other one home. It was pretty awesome.
And what time was that?
That was at 2:45 in the afternoon. Whoever, I don't know if it was a daughter or a wife or whatever, was there just like chain smoking and being like, Daryl, come on, calm down, Daryl. Calm down, you need to relax, Daryl. And, you know, Daryl's like, nah, fuck this. You know, I cut down on my drinking. And, you know, the dad's like, nah, you did. He had a way higher voice than the son for some reason. Nah, you ain't cut down nothing. It was like fucking absolute redneck shenanigans. The last pre-COVID year, I was actually walking to my parked car, and there was just a woman passed out in an alleyway, and not like because she didn't have anywhere else to go, because those people I see sometimes, and I usually let them be. But this woman was just like in her St. Patty's Day outfit, passed out drunk in the alleyway, and I was like a little worried, and so I nudged her with my foot, and she was like, ugh! And I was like, okay, you're alive. So I flipped her onto her side. I just like kind of to make sure she didn't like vomit and choke to death. And then I was just like, you need anything, ma'am? And she's like, ugh. And I'm like, okay, I'm done with this shit. So that was my, oh, and it was so cold this year that they technically canceled the holiday festivities. It was frigid, 18 with wind chill. And people were still out in their booty shorts. People were still out in their short skirts. It's crazy. Everyone came out anyways, but it means they're doing it again this coming Saturday. So it's two Saturdays of chaos in a row. I'm relatively excited. Hopefully it's warmer. I don't know if there's like an equivalent of that in y'all's lives, but every year it's like this. And it's always a shit show.
Do we have anything equivalent, Cheryl?
I was trying to think that, pre-COVID, people took New Year's Eve pretty seriously. You know, everyone would go to Lan Kwai.
I never got into the Lan Kwai culture. So Lan Kwai is basically a street where all the expats go drink. And I'm not an expat because I'm a local boy, baby. Born and bred in Hong Kong.
It's true, he's a Hong Kong baby.
I was wondering, like, when is it most crazy in Lan Kwai? Because I actually have never gone to Lan Kwai much, ever.
I'm definitely no expert on Lan Kwai. I'm more homebody, but I think it gets pretty, I think New Year's Eve and like Halloween, Christmas.
So Suede, I have a few questions for you. First of all, what the fuck is a St. Patty's outfit?
So if you're in Roanoke and you're a dude, any flavor of bad nu metal jeans from the 2000s, so like JNCOs, jean shorts, anything to make you look like a giant douchebag, and then a green shirt with some stupid phrase like, give me a drink, I'm Irish, or like, you know, kiss the Irish stone, and just like backwards baseball cap, a cigarette. And this is also only if you're white. The black people you see downtown during St. Patty's Day are just regular. They're here to party, but they don't dress up like the white crowd. And the women are always dressed, again, this is the white women, are always dressed in short shorts or short skirts with like some flavor of leg covers, usually like, what do you call them?
Tights?
Fishnets.
Stockings.
Fishnets, stockings. And then green hair and green lipstick and a low cut shirt. A lot of flesh, a lot of green, a lot of smoking. If you go into the bathrooms at the VAR, you'll always wind up with like finding a toilet that's full of green vomit because they dye the cheapest beer green for St. Patrick's Day. I know, and it's like, we don't have a huge Irish population in Roanoke. Like, there's not like a group of Irish people who are like super hype. It's literally just like dumb, drunk rednecks. I like Roanoke. I like the people here, but I don't know. The St. Patty's Day crowd is just, like, fucking terrible. Like, the bartender had to, like, mace four dudes. The bartender next to our store had to, like, mace four dudes so that they didn't punch a server. You don't need to do that. That's fucking unnecessary.
This is the first time St. Patty crowd people interact with surfers, so it's, like, you know, scary.
Walter, not surfer. A server. Did you think I was talking about surfboards? Did you honestly right now answer my question? Did you think we were talking about surfboards?
Yeah, I heard surfer.
Walter does this.
Have you interacted with Walter in the context of him not knowing words? Like, does that happen outside of he and I?
This happens every time we talk.
It's so funny, right?
It's hilarious.
Do you have a favorite?
I just remember telling him the first time that he did this thing where he'll like nod and like, you know, give you affirmation while you're talking, and then 10 minutes later you realize he has like a complete different interpretation of what you're saying. A lot of U-turns.
We used to translate for Walter in class when we had classes together. Walter would like raise his hand, and this is after he's drinking, because he used to take oyster sauce bottles,
the one with panda on it,
and when he'd finished using the sauce he would fill them with whiskey.
No.
And he would drink them in class.
That is so disgusting.
Well, and it would be like 9 in the morning. I once watched Walter, and how much, those are like 12 ounce bottles, God. Right?
Why, Walter? Why the Lee Kumke bottle?
Well, if we're asking why I drink in class, this is my motto. Drinking in class is not fun, but hey, at least you're drunk.
But drinking in class from an oyster bottle is more fun, right?
At like 8:45.
Why do you put it in an oyster bottle? Oyster sauce bottle.
So the popular stuff I put it in was in Dr. Pepper, but I didn't really like doing that because it made it look like I drank soda in the morning. So that was kind of weird.
Which is really weird compared to whiskey.
Yeah. I don't know. You know what also happened? I think one time I brought alcohol through some type of security by putting it through oyster sauce and then telling them that it was oyster sauce. And it just made me realize, wow, I can get away with things in America if I fucking put alcohol into our Chinese weird gibberish kind of bottles, and all these American security guards are like, what the fuck is this? And it kind of just became a habit. It might actually be genetic too, because my dad used to tell me that my grandma got away with bringing a bunch of weird shit into America, because whenever the customs were like stopping her and asking her like, okay, what is all this, she would just go for soup in her old Chinese cute short lady grandma style.
That's baller. I respect that.
Yeah.
I mean, what would she sneak in?
Just like a bunch of dried vegetables and probably some dried meat.
Oh, so that is for soup. She wasn't lying.
Yeah. I just don't know if they can actually get through customs, technically. Speaking of food, though, what do people eat for St. Patty's Day?
Green peas.
Leprechauns.
Yeah, they just like go out and they suck leprechaun dicks for like 24 hours. It's not a real holiday. It's just an excuse to get wasted, which normally I'm into, but it makes people fight, which I'm less into.
The surfers, yeah.
Wait, say that again?
It makes the surfers fight.
It makes the surfers fight. They're too drunk. They can't surf. They get mad. Bro, what the fuck, man?
Chill, dude.
You're harshing my vibe, bro.
Dude, that's why they probably fight all the time. There's no food to eat, so they're probably starving. It's probably like a famine kind of situation going on.
Potato famine.
Potato famine. One last question, Suede. For all your complaints about St. Patty's Day, why are you there?
Yeah, if you hate it so much, why don't you just go back to your surfboard?
Well, I have to, first of all, my surfboard is parked past all the shenanigans. So I have to walk through, I have to wade through the chaos to get to my surfboard. I'm also at work, but the main thing that frustrates me is that I can't be included. I'm jealous that I can't wander into this chaotic fray for a multitude of reasons. The main one being that I am an anxious inside child. And, you know, like, this year in particular, I can't, because it's fucking COVID, and we're all gonna die if we fucking drink beer with these unvaccinated rednecks. And some of it is also, I don't like seeing the, like, massive gap. All these people are, like, out having fun, and, like, meanwhile, the homeless people who are, like, standing, like, 15 feet away are, like, begging for change. And, you know, on Christmas or whatever, people are, like, more giving, so they're, like, willing to give money to the homeless people and stuff. But St. Patty's Day is just a bunch of drunk assholes. So the homeless people just have to, like, watch while other people have fun.
Cheryl, you said you like all holidays, but do you ever have times where, like, you hate a holiday because you're kind of jealous of everyone having fun? Because honestly, there's a high chance that everything that I hate, 80% of it is jealousy.
I think I feel I like holidays even for the potential for me to be jealous. And so, for sure, I feel jealous every holiday. Like, even if I were to be lonely on a holiday, I think I would still like it for its, like, symbolic weight and, like, the drama of, like, going out
the
and
drama. That's
being like,
awesome.
Damn, that person's having an amazing fill-in-the-blank holiday, and I'm not. But I still like it because there's drama and there's something to yearn for.
No, that's honestly super amazing, because I am a very proponent of changing the negative emotions to be kind of something you can enjoy and romanticize. I haven't done that with jealousy a lot. This is a new open-ended book of my brain that I must open up.
This is Jealous Walter 2022.
Yes, that is my New Year's resolution. A little late, but
to be more jealous.
Let us be more jealous and enjoy it.
I'll be honest, Cheryl. I'm jealous that you're in Hong Kong near my lover, Walter. I'm mad that I'm not you in this moment.
It's okay. You're Frank Ocean. You know, you got the surfers.
That's true. I have Frank Ocean's clout. I have the surfers.
Clout, count your blessings.
Blessings.
Clout, shout, mount. Mountain Dew. Mountain Dew.
The rhymes are back again, baby.
The rhymes are back. The rhymes are back. When I can't think of anything funny to say, I just say rhyming words.
Feel you.
It's the new bit.
Also do that sometimes.
I think I just have one more question for you, Cheryl. Let's say Calendar Man rolls up. It's St. Patty's Day. And he says, oh, it's St. Patrick's Day. And your St. Patrick's Day leprechaun quiz, you must choose. And he has a big gun. And he points it at you. And then he says, I will either shoot Frank Ocean or your boyfriend. Which will it be? And you have to decide. Who would it be?
I would choose Frank Ocean. I'm a good girl. What can I say?
Choose.
Also, Frank Ocean is you, Suede.
That's true. It's me.
Yeah, so, you would kill me. You know, after all this, after the past, you know, I actually decided to, have Calendar Man do that anyway.
Yeah, it's like a service, right? You're doing a service to the planet by having my life ended.
Yeah.
Right? I actually think you are right. I think that's the correct choice.
A week ago, I saw Come On, Come On. I mean, Joaquin Phoenix is in it. I saw people talking about how good the screenplay was. It's a black and white movie. It looked like some artsy, indie, Francis Ha type movie to me. So I was like, maybe I'll like it. Title sounded promising. Watched it. Was really disappointed. looked at all the reviews. And didn't understand why everybody loved it so much. That being said, I don't want to hate on the movie. I'm not a critic. And I don't like people that only shit on movies and, you know, don't talk about things that they like. So I'm not going to go there. But I was disappointed. And I still, to this day, don't really understand. Like, I just think it's overrated. And there are things that I liked about the movie. I thought the acting was all phenomenal from every character, but I just thought the writing and the arc, not that every story has to have an arc, but it was just so flat and it didn't take me anywhere. It didn't feel like it took the characters
anywhere.
That's
pretty good, Cheryl. Either. I will have to say, we have a rule about not being negative about movies on the podcast, so I am going to have to ask you to leave, but thank you for joining us. This was a really good time.
You know what? Calendar Man's about to get you, so.
It's true. Oh, God, he's behind God me. Damn
it, that was my bit. I was prepared to shit on Cheryl, too, for bringing negative energy. Okay. Technically, you know what? You can call a movie overrated. You can call a movie it didn't meet match your hype. You just can't say a movie is the three-letter word that starts with a B.
Well, because there are movies that are overhyped that I enjoyed. You know what I liked? I liked The Godfather. It's kind of overhyped. I don't think it's like a masterpiece movie, but I enjoyed it. It's fun. Mm-hmm. I'd still rather watch Hellraiser. But like, it's a fun movie. I've not seen many Joaquin Phoenix movies. I know he was in The Joker, and he was also in a movie where he gets pooped on. And those are the two things I know about Joaquin Phoenix.
I haven't seen that one.
He was the little boy in Salo?
Yeah, he was a little boy. He was every little boy in Salo. We gotta stop talking about Salo, man. We gotta stop talking about that movie on the podcast.
Okay.
I'm interested, though. So you said the story, the movie didn't take you anywhere and the characters didn't take you anywhere. Was this like another plotless, pretentious film? Like, does it have a plot?
Yeah, but the plot is like a one-liner. Like, yeah, I mean, it's about, essentially, Joaquin Phoenix is a radio journalist who's supposed to be, from the write-up, from the synopsis that I read before the movie, he's supposed to be emotionally very guarded, and then he meets his nephew, which is his sister's son, and basically they open up.
Nephew is right.
yeah. I have to explain for Walter.
That's true. Yeah, Walter, did you know that? Did you know what a nephew was?
I don't think I would ever use those words to describe a nephew.
Anyway, they're supposed to have gone through an emotional transformation by the end of the film by spending time with each other and asking each other difficult questions. Essentially, he learns to see the world from the point of view of a child. And, you know, that synopsis sounded really promising to me because...
Yeah, it sounds beautiful.
I actually love movies. I love movies and books that are from the perspective of a child. One of my favorite books, it's called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Half of it is written from the perspective of a child and it's super heartbreaking and just beautiful. But I just thought, come on, was kind of a letdown because, yeah, I don't know. I want to hear what Walter thinks of the movie. I know Walter saw it, so I'd like to talk about it with him.
Actually, let's do an applause first. For the great company, distribution company, and production company of A24. Congratulations, you made it to our podcast. Great job. Yeah, it's an A24 film.
I have seen one of them, their movies. Didn't they make that movie about the alchemist, the guy out in the woods who turns into a monster?
No, that's Oscilloscope. Oh. You're talking about Alchemist Cookbook.
Wait, no. What are some other A24 movies?
Moonlight.
Okay, I've seen that one. There's not enough wizards in that one for me.
Weren't all the Ari Aster films A24?
Oh, yeah, Midsommar and Hereditary. That's true.
Okay, those kind of have wizards in them.
That's true, they do.
Yeah, that's cool. I like wizards.
The Lighthouse was A24.
I know that looked good. It has Robert Pattinson in it, right? And also Willem Dafoe?
Yeah. Mid-90s was A24. Eighth Grade, Lady Bird, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, The Florida Project, A Ghost Story.
These are all movies I remember being at the theater while I worked there and everyone being like, all the pretentious people going to those movies. It was never like the dude in the John Cena t-shirt who was like down to see Lady Bird. He was like, yeah, I'm ready for Transformers Rise of the Fallen. And then the dude would come in like, and he'd like be wearing like a pea coat. He'd be like, I'm here to see Lady Bird.
So even you who haven't like seen a lot of A24 films, you have your own stereotype of what A24 movies are.
Yeah.
So I would say this film doesn't stray too far away from that stereotype. In fact, I would also add, I think this film is like a mumblecore movie that was made by A24. So that's how I would describe it. So mumblecore,
awesome.
If people don't know about it, it's a genre that came out in America from like the early 2000s to before 2010s, where just people made indie films with people talking and mumbling. That's why it's called mumblecore.
I thought mumblecore was hip hop. I thought that was a hip hop thing.
Mumble
no,
rap.
No, that's mumble rap. It's like Lil Pete mumble rap? Lil Pete? Lil Xan? XXXTacion?
But yeah, I like the movie because... The dialogue is... Do I even like the dialogue? Let me think.
Do you even like where you are in life?
Do I even like where I am in life?
That's yeah, what is
this podcast?
What do you like?
I like Anna Karina.
Sure, you like Anna Karina.
So, okay. I think the film is a little cringy. But what I thought was interesting was it kind of made me sympathize with a kid that I would have gotten rid of for adoption almost on day one. And... I think that made that movie kind of interesting to me.
Wait, so, why are you going to give this kid up for adoption? What's wrong with
him? Because he's spoiled, he's annoying, and he's fucking loud. And he fucking Walter. Runs off in New York City. Yeah, I know what you're going to say. That's you. But that I'm not giving myself for adoption, dude. That's my parents' fault, not mine. If I had myself, I'd be up for adoption, too.
Now I'm thinking that people that like this movie are just like the heartless assholes that don't have any empathy for children at all.
But you've already said you have empathy for children in other movies.
No, what I'm saying is that I do have empathy, and I'm not a heartless asshole like Walter is. That's why I don't think the movie is particularly shocking in terms of like bringing the audience into the world of a child.
I actually think it's important that the kid is kind of annoying. I mean, I know the kid is innocent, so I'm not taking away the innocence from them. But from the outside viewing in, the kid is annoying and has issues. But the film still wants you to sympathize with that type of yelling and the kid being upset.
Yeah, I get that. I also think what's interesting is I want to talk to more people that were born and raised in Asia and see that film, because I think parenting in Asia and in the West is super different. Like, that same kid could not have gone the same empathy or sympathy if they were raised by traditional Asian parents. Like, the film is just so American. It's so like, you know, this child, he runs away, but it's really because he blah, 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 blah. Psychology, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, in Asia, it would just be like, damn, you're fucking rude.
I like blah, 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 because that's what the kid says all the time, too.
Yeah, true.
I mean, that's a fair point. Okay, here's, like, a bit of what happens in the movie, too. They interview, like, a bunch of kids to ask them, like, what do they think of the future of the world, humanity. They never use the word America. And a lot of their answers are, like, I'm hoping good stuff for humans and all this stuff. But that's, like, why I think the tension between innocence and a spoiled brat, and none of the kids are spoiled, but I think that tension is real in that movie, because these kids, even though their answer are very innocent by saying, and I want the best for humanity, that's an incredibly American-centric understanding of your future. Because, I don't know, like, do you think, like, Asian kids would ever think about humanity? Right from the beginning where you're born as an Asian, you're always aware that America is not you, or the West is not you. So you can never make these grander claims of world peace.
Yeah, I think so. Although I don't know if it's a generational thing, or, you know, I don't know what kids in Hong Kong in 2022 think. Because of the internet, I think we have more access to these grander, like, potentials.
That's the whole thing about the American dream, right? Like, it's baked into the landscape of the United States of America, this idea that there is an American dream, right? It's all about progression. It's all about reaching a goal. And the ugly truth about living in America is that it's a fallacy. The dream is there to act as a yoke upon you. If you can, like, learn to accept that you're not going to have the trophy wife and the 2.5 kids and the house with the garage, and you're like, no, life is like way more complicated than that, and it's never going to be Leave It to Beaver. You're like better off, but the system does not, the American system does not want you to reach that. The American system wants you to continue to strive for something that's unreachable. And that's like, you know, that's been in the media of good literature from the United States of America since its genesis, right? I mean, that's the premise of Home to Harlem. There's a lot of that in Invisible Man too, Death of a Salesman.
Well, the thing with what you just mentioned is that's why this movie is unique to me, because instead of doing it in this sort of adulthood, it's a little less scary to question innocence in adults. When you start questioning innocence in kids, holy fuck, then you get some complicated problems of like, are you telling me to strip innocence from kids or what? And I think the movie never strips the innocence from the kids, telling them their innocence is bad. And I think it celebrates it, but I think it does make that innocence look a little spoiled in that American dream. And I think that was something I thought a lot about after the movie, about how to deal with kids when they're part of the fucking system. Like, you can't say they're responsible, but well,
they may be one
they're
day.
Part of it still.
Yeah.
But they may be
and
one
they,
day.
They may become part of it. And I think you can also, you can push further, right? That innocence is only allowed for certain kids in America, right? I have a friend who works, yep. downtown. And there's a group of kids who come into her store who steal a good bit. And, you know, she doesn't care all that much, except for she'll get fired if she doesn't tell them to leave. And all these kids are like 11 to 14 and they're all black. And, you know, she's black too. And she, you know, she levels with these kids, right? She's like, you can't keep stealing in this store, not only because I'm going to get fired, but because if you do this, someone will kill you, most likely a police officer. And so these kids don't get their innocence for that context. Like I was raised to distrust cops, but I didn't understand why. I was never afraid around a cop, right? But there are plenty of kids in America who from birth are like, oh, fuck, you know, they don't get that innocence, right? There's a specific group of people who are allowed access.
I guess the only thing I didn't like about it was like every time it went back to the mom, all her lines were the same. All her lines were like, yeah, you know, that's what having a kid is like. And then 30 minutes later, it's the same thing. Like the kid runs away or does something innocent but irresponsible, reasonably, from a kid. And then it goes back to the mom. And she's like, yeah, it's just so tough. Which is not to dismiss that it is tough. I'm sure it is. But I just felt like the script was repetitive. And that's what I mean by I found the movie kind of
it's
flat.
It's boring, right, to hear, like, oh, it's hard being a parent. Because, like, yeah, we all know. We've all seen the dinosaurs with the baby. You know, you ever see the dinosaurs, Cheryl?
I have not.
Oh, my God. You got to watch this fucking show. It's this puppet show with these dinosaurs who are, like, living during dinosaur times. But they have, like, jobs and wear shirts. And there's this, like, little pink baby dinosaur. And he doesn't call the dad. He just calls the dad not the mama. And he'll sneak up behind the dad with the frying pan and be like, not the mama, and hit him with the frying pan. Yeah, no one wants to hear people complain about how hard it is to be a parent, because we all know. We all either are parents or have parents or both. And it's like, we get it.
I mean, I definitely don't know, because I've never been there, and neither have either of you. But my problem isn't that she said that or that the movie was about that. Like, my problem isn't that it was about parenthood. Blah. My problem was only that the script was just repetitive, is all. I don't want to like shit on parenthood or like movies that try to portray that, because I think it's great.
I think the looping and the stagnancy of it, there is a bit that parenting, you never learn it. Like, it never gets better. I don't know if I can make a statement like that.
Well, I mean, yeah. That gets back to this fallacy of the American dream, right? Like, you know, the idea that you're going to have this ideal, perfect relationship with anyone is a fallacy. No, there's no perfect relationship. It requires upkeep. It requires practice, right? Whether it be a friendship or, you know, a romantic relationship or a parent and child. I mean, I still, like, you know, I live with my folks and my little brother, and, like, we're still negotiating, sort of like the way we live together, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think this, the closer you come to accepting that, the easier it is to, like, make it through cohabitation. I struggle with it sometimes. I mean, we had issues with this living together. Well, we had a few run-ins.
Of course.
Tell me about it. I want to hear this.
You want to hear the run-ins? I mean, none of them are, they're all...
I have a good story.
Okay.
All right, so I'm a very passive-aggressive person. Yeah. I like to not confront people and kind of just frown and sulk and not really talk to you for a while. Suede is a very confrontational person.
I do hitting.
Yeah, Suede likes to hit and ask you, like, what the fuck is wrong with you, and hit you, and then try to make you laugh, so then it's, like, not a big deal anymore. It's like, are you smiling? Uh-huh. Are you still upset, baby boy? You're laughing.
Yeah.
That means you're not sad anymore, right? So that's what Suede likes to do. There is this one time Suede tried to use passive-aggressive back at me because he was sick and tired of being the confrontational person, because it takes all the energy.
He said something about my writing, too, which had made me really angry. It was something, like, very rude and uncalled for about something I cared about. I was very angry.
Gotcha. So I just have never made Suede angry enough, but he decided to play the passive-aggressive card. We lived in the same room, so Suede would get up in the morning, immediately go outside in the living room, and, like, just avoid me. And I would stay in the bed and avoid him, because I was passive-aggressive, too. And 3 days later, Suede came back in and was like, Walter, I can't do this anymore. I'm not good at the passive-aggressive thing.
And dude, it was not 3 days. It was, like, 12 hours.
Okay.
It was like 12 hours of me being passive aggressive and then being like, oh my God, I hate this. I remember coming in and slamming your computer shut too. I remember, like, being so frustrated, like, fuck this. Just, like, closing your computer.
It was very cute. It made me feel extra bad about being that passive aggressive too. But I didn't show it because I'm too masculine for that.
Well, and then on the other hand, when we started living together, like all three of us, you, me, and Tori, I grew up like in a physical household with like in physical with my friends. And like there was a lot of roughhousing and I would get annoyed at you guys. And so I would pick you up and I would shake you. I thought it was really fun. And after like 4 days of this, we had there, you guys were like, we have to talk about this. We have to have a meeting. You can't keep doing this. Like, what do you mean? It's just fun guys. We're just razzing each other. And they're like, no, Suede, you're hurting us. I'm like, no, come on. It's fine.
There are some things that even though we like approached each other about boundaries, we never stopped. For example, Tori, the person who else lived with us, we would like to move his stuff on his desk because every single time something got moved, he would notice. Like he literally had the fucking Pictionary memory of the fucking desk that he has of all his little objects.
Yeah, you could fuck with him like that.
Yeah, you could like move his, I don't know, hourglass upside down and he would like have to move the hourglass back.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
And one time he was like, you guys have to stop doing this. It really bugs me. We never stopped.
Yeah, no, we never stopped. Poor Tori. He really did. We really did do a number on him because Walter and I were still drinking a lot at the time. There was a lot of chaos. I remember once I threw a microwave waffle on the ceiling and got a stick up there, and Tori blew a gasket. He was so angry. And we never did get the waffle stain off the ceiling. That's probably the angriest I ever saw Tori, was when I threw the waffle on the ceiling.
All right, so before we start, I cut this out last week because I'm a crappy editor. So I'm just going to play that clip that I cut out. Hoodie, hoodie! I will say, though, that this film has no plot. It's not a plot.
Oh, God. It's one of these. What is it with you? Why can't you just bring in a good movie that's got a plot?
All right. Next week, I will fucking bring Ant-Man.
Okay, bring Ant-Man.
I am not bringing fucking
Marvel. Do it, coward. I'm not bringing a fucking Marvel. Do it, coward. Movie, dude. You won't do it.
Okay, if I bring a fucking mainstream story movie, you have to bring the art house movie to balance it out.
Okay, fine.
Not an art house movie, a no plot art house
movie. Okay, a pretentious film. I'll find the most pretentious, nonsensical, fucking shenanigan ass movie I can. I'm gonna be like, oh yes, if you can see the sort of delicate balance of, my ass crack.
This week, we're gonna change gears. I'm gonna bring the fucking mainstream Marvel film, and Suede's going to bring an art house movie.
So Walter sent me a list of some of his favorite movies, and I was looking through, and I saw a movie called Dravida from 1973, directed by Mani Kaul, who's a sort of famous director for doing Hindi films. And I was like, oh, sweet, a ghost. Basically, the premise of this movie is a ghost sees a beautiful woman going to get married and is like, I want to be her husband instead. And so when her husband leaves, he turns into him, the husband, and goes and gets to be his wife, or her husband. And I was super excited because that sounds awesome. And I want to say a few things about this movie. One of the key things I forgot about Indian movies made in India is that their censor board is really intense. They censor a lot of stuff, and the farther back you go in time, the more censored movies are. And so I was kind of excited to see some hot ghost sex, and then I remembered that for the most part, you can't really show kissing, or at least you couldn't in like the 70s and 80s. So there's almost no physical intimacy in this movie, despite it being about ghost romance, which is because of the censors.
Are you talking out of your ass? For sure. I mean,
no,
like, do you know this movie did not have tender stuff? Did not have physical intimacy tender. Solely because of the censor.
Not solely, but I know a lot of movies didn't. A lot of movies, you weren't. There was a censor board to make sure this would be allowed.
All right.
This is like a big thing.
That's fine. I just was curious. That's all.
So I watched this movie and I tried to think about it from a Walter point of view because there's like no swords, there's no crazy action, there's nothing all that fucked up. Which are like the three things I really enjoy. And I have to say, I think there's actually a lot going on in this movie that's pretty engaging. Walter, you like colors. That's like a thing you're into, right?
Colors like in general?
In cinema.
So this is kind of a weird one because there's not a whole lot of like super traditional shots. A lot of things are like done through angles or like with characters walking behind or in front of things. Most of the things they're walking in front of are these pillars in this like eggshell white giant house covered in stairs. So you're just having these characters like walk up and down stairs. You'll just see like as the ghost husband is like walking up the stairs, he's got like a big yellow turban, and then he's dressed in a white shirt, and then the background is white. And so there's just this like little yellow hat floating on top. Or the wife character wears a lot of red and a lot of yellow, and you'll see her walking down the stairs, but you don't ever even see her head really. You just see her walking down the stairs, and it's like stark white with reds and yellows. And I was like, oh, that's like really, really quite beautiful. And there's a lot of stuff like that. And the first 16 minutes of the movie don't actually really show much footage of the characters' bodies straight on. It's all these like half shots and stuff like that. So it really is kind of like a kaleidoscope of colors and characters talking, but they're not even talking. It's all voiceover with just like static faces, which was kind of interesting and kind of cool. And then there's a lot of other segments where the characters are just like walking to or from somewhere, and they're just bird noises. They're just animal noises. And that's another moment where I'm sitting there and I'm like, man, there is not a single sword in this movie. What the fuck? And then I'm like, yeah, but if I was a Walter, if I was a sweet baby Walter looking at the screen right now, I would be like, man, that animal has been captured forever on screen. In that moment, that animal making noise in the city, and it's not a pet. It's just so beautiful. You know, like, so I was like, okay, I get it. Finally, you see a full-on shot of the female lead, and I was like, oh, okay, I see why Walter likes this movie. She's very cute. She is right in Walter's strike zone. And I realized something about your taste, Walter. You like movies where not a lot happens, and the women who get shown on screen are very pretty.
That is fair. I do love movies like that, for sure.
Anna Karina's
a good example. So, well, why is this your favorite movie? Is it literally just because she's pretty and the movie's pretty? Or is there, like, weirder stuff going on? Because there is weird stuff going on. The ghost is hilarious, sort of. There's not a lot of jokes, but there's like a funny bit where like they trick the ghost into going into a bag, because the ghost has been living in a banyan tree, and then he sees the woman and he's like, oh, I love her, I gotta become her husband. And the husband eventually comes back, and they're like, oh fuck, which is the husband? And so this like wise shepherd does all these like fake tests to see who the husband is, and at the end he's like, whoever is the real husband needs to go inside this bag. And the ghost is like, I got it. And then they're like, yeah, because you're a ghost that you can go in this bag. So they just throw the ghost down a well. In a bag. They just throw the bag down a well as ghost punishment. And the whole way the ghost is like, no, I'll help you, shepherd. Don't throw me down the well. And also, you know, this is the other thing that's crazy. The fucking ghost impregnates the woman. Like, she has a legit ass kid.
Fuck.
Even though he's a ghost.
Is a kid half ghost?
I don't know. He does not seem like a Danny Phantom. He does not. He seems like a flesh and blood ghost boy. So you just, I mean, I guess you have to assume ghost jizz is a thing that, like, works and functions. I don't know.
The reason why I was curious about what you said about the censorship stuff, about no kissing and all that stuff, is because I actually feel like that was part of the stylistic choice of the movie. This film is a romance story. And the ghost does nothing wrong and still gets fucked for it, right, in the end.
It is interesting that the ghost did nothing wrong, because you'd think that the ghost is going to act like an asshole, but when he shows up after, so he tricks the husband's parents into thinking that he's not a ghost, and then when he shows up to the wife, I was expecting the ghost to be like, yeah, I'm the husband, and then he's like, nah, I'm the ghost, sorry, I like really think you're really cute, and I love you and want to spend time with you, but I am the ghost. Not your husband. And then the lady says, you know, she says this later, like, I didn't have any power to keep my husband from leaving, because he goes off to make a fortune for 5 years. And I couldn't say anything about that and coming here. So why would I say anything about having the ghost leave? And very apathetic. There's a lot of apathy from the wife in this film, and anxiety, but like apathetic anxiety. She doesn't want to, she's very nervous about leaving her village and going to this like fancy ass house. There's like a whole section where she even says, oh, what is the line? Cause it's fantastic. My mother's womb held me close, but my father's home did not, right? Because her parents were obsessed with her getting married. It's just like so heavy. It feels like a Sylvia Plath line. I mean, that's like a fucking Sylvia Plath line to the T.
Yeah.
And actually, some of the apathy that the main female lead presented reminded me a little bit of some of the apathy that you see in The Bell Jar. The stories are very different, but a similar level of like inability to make emotional statements, right? Like living in an emotional world and making statements, but not making statements that are like, I want this, or I need this, or I feel this. So there's like a lot of stuff going on with her as far as like apathy goes. It's really interesting. So that my relationship with this movie is complicated, but I want to know why, Walter, this is one of your favorites.
Let's dive straight into it. Let's go over the full fucking pretentious fucking shit. I am going to introduce a phrase I just made up. I want to say that DeVita and, in general, Manny Call's films, for me, show a type of discontinuous poetry that I really like. A thing where flow... Sorry, people are already shaking their heads.
Such a fucking pretentious douche. What are you talking about?
Go on.
It is very related to what I am obsessed with this film about. The fragmented shots of people's bodies. My favorite part is the conversation part. A lot of times these characters are talking to each other, but as you said, it's a voiceover.
Yeah, so the characters are just looking either at each other or directly at the camera.
Directly at the camera, exactly. Conversations are supposed to feel personal on a communicative level. You and me are talking, and there's this flow where we together are in the same mood or in the same zone.
Right, there's a back and forth.
But is every conversation like that? Sometimes the best conversations don't happen like that, where two people are so self-centered into their own thoughts and they're just throwing ideas into one another's, into this space of conversation that never actually gets digested between each two other. I would say debates are like that. That's why debates are on TV. Sweet's face is like super
I'm flabbergasted. I'm not mad. I'm just like, that fucking mess you just said about conversation. What the fuck are you talking about? Cheryl, do you know what the fuck he's talking about? Does that make sense to you as a statement?
Not really.
Okay, good. It's not just me. And I'm normally good at figuring out what you're fucking talking about.
I think what the problem is I'm not a very poetic person. Okay, so fuck the debates and stuff like that. I might have like gone at this in the wrong way, but Cheryl, can I ask you a question? When you write music, is it not that some of your songs feel like you're piecing together fragmentations and then connecting the fragments together so that there's only a very unstable thread of stability that links the two fragments together, and that is almost more pretty than a continuous link of just things that make sense that
totally flow?
Yeah, Cheryl, don't you know when the stability of the unstable stability makes a fragment of connections? It's so beautiful.
I kind of get that. I mean,
can you explain it to me then? Because I didn't get any of that.
I guess you didn't have to use the word stability or instability. It's just breaking, abstractifying. No, backspace. Essentially, I think what he's trying to say is that sometimes it's prettier when things aren't. Sometimes the train is prettier if the carriages are not linked to each other.
I mean, I was giving both you and Walter a hard time, but I think that does make sense. And I think one of the core differences between Walter and I is that I'm not really interested in things being pretty. I actually get bored of pretty very interesting. I'd much rather have something be upsetting or gross. So, like, I really like Gummo for that reason. It was gross. It's disconnected both narratively rather than being disconnected filmically and via the dialogue, right? It's a different movie from DeRavita. But this idea of showing things outside of their context, outside of their connected context, and just giving them like their own space, is like curating an image. Do you think that's an accurate description of what you're talking about? The idea of curating an image for you to look at within a larger, or a sound, if we're doing music.
It's kind of like in a photo series, a juxtaposition of two images is more interesting because there's more room for interpretation and for the reader to assume parallels instead of being like, this is a metaphor for blah, blah.
I do think one of my sticking points of this movie is how pretty everything is. It's like boring to me. It's just like, one of my favorite parts is when the shepherd is like, whoever's the real husband has to let me put this giant sharp blade end of my shepherd's crook into your mouth. And the first husband, the real husband, is like, no, that's disgusting. And the ghost husband is like, I'll do it. And he just like licks this like rusty metal hook. And I was like, yeah, okay, cool. We're finally getting some cool shit. Or there are these sections where the family's rich and they're giving out these food to these dudes. And the food just look like bricks almost, like these little chunky blocks of food. And there are like flies all over the food that the guy keeps like brushing away to give out these chunks to people. And I was like, cool, flies, weird, miscellaneous food. So I think some of my the things I didn't love about this movie was just the visuals aren't quite my aesthetic, right?
So if we're talking about what makes this movie so important to me, is I'm obsessed with the complexity of the main woman and her relationship with love in this movie. Her relationship is very weird, right?
See, I don't know why you think she was happy in any of this. I think it was apathy. I think
that's the point.
That's
the point, though.
I think
that makes it complicated.
I don't know if that's all that complicated of a statement, talking about how the, you know, fucking patriarchy's fucked up, but the idea that, like, it's hard to be a woman when marriage is transactional did not surprise me. I was like, okay, yeah. I got this. This is not news to me. And her apathy reminds me of, like, a lot of different pieces of media that I've interacted with. I was not surprised by the apathy. I liked it. I think it is one of the more interesting elements, but I don't know if I'd call her complicated. I don't think I'd call any of the characters very complicated.
I think to just be like, okay, this is a social justice film.
I don't know if I'd call it a social justice film either. I'm just saying I don't. Don't you fucking put words in my mouth. I'll fucking kick your ass.
He'll lift you up.
Just reducing it to the patriarchy is reductive.
No, and that's true. Is it true? I don't know.
Because I don't think the film is like, okay.
No, Go for it. Fucking fight me on this.
What's the point of making this film so romantic and so tender in a stylistic way if you're just trying to fucking say, oh, it's the patriarchy? Like, I think that's a weird thing to choose to do.
That's fair, because there are some really tender moments with her and the ghost. And there's also some tender moments with the kid. I think for me, part of why it felt like kind of maybe a little one-dimensional is some of the dialogue. Because there's so little dialogue, it all has so much weight. Very rarely is the dialogue not within context of a relationship, and a male-female relationship. So it's hard for me not to start drawing parallels, right? But I, again, for me, there's some nuance that is missed because of sort of how sort of like pretty and beautiful the visuals are. I get bored, so I don't notice the things that you pick up on. But
yeah, I don't know. Cheryl, you want to join in as the tokenized person of color woman in this? Do you ever feel like movies that come out from Asia get reduced when it comes to patriarchy?
I think this is a tough one because I haven't listened to a lot of discussions of Asian films by American podcasters. Like I haven't really had these discussions, but I'm sure it does, because I know for a fact that it happens in music. Like, if you're an Asian artist trying to make it in the West, often your music is reduced to, like, there's just a way smaller range of, you're just always reduced because you're tokenized. You know, I see it in music all the time. Writers and artists, like musical artists that come from Asia are often only ever applauded for their, it's always portrayed as like their obsession or devotion to their culture. But white artists can talk about anything.
When you look at literature written by either Asian Americans or Asian people that's translated into English, a lot of it is exactly what you're talking about, is about like the Asian identity trying to survive in the West.
Yeah.
Interior Chinatown is one of those. With the exception of people who write genre, even the people who write genre stuff, right? Cien Liu's Three Body Problem, a lot people instantly went to connecting the sci-fi space opera epic to Maoist China, right? Like that's a lot of the discourse is right there, is like about like this is an allegory for Mao, instead of it just being like a sweet space story.
Yeah, like we're not afforded the time or space to just talk about mundane things in life because we're not seen as the norm or someone that's relatable.
You're right. Cheryl convinced me that you're right. I'm taking the L on this one. I'm the loser. I'm the loser and you're the bruiser. Bruise my skin.
I'm gonna drag you in a bag like that ghost and throw you in a well.
Yeah, throw me down a well. Throw me down a fucking well. Do you think that's where Sadako came from, the ring girl? Do you think she's the same ghost? She crawls out the well?
Yeah, probably. The movie I brought is Shang-Chi and the Legend of Ten Rings. Sorry, I kind of forgot the title. It's too long. It doesn't make sense to me. Why do we need a movie that has such a long title?
Oh, this is like an actual Marvel movie. I'd forgotten this came out. So you brought an actual legit-ass Marvel movie.
I did. I promised, you fucking idiot. I fucking promised. I did cheat a little because it is about Asians. So in order to make this deal fair, I do want to talk a little bit about plot. Well, one guy named Shang-Chi was wandering around in a Chinatown somewhere on the West Coast. And Awkwafina, his childhood friend, has a huge crush on him. And then Shang-Chi gets a ton of powers. Shang-Chi has to find his dad. That's what happens. And his dad is the ultimate villain. And
what is the 10 rings? Does he have 10 magic rings that shoot lasers or something?
His dad has 10 magic rings, and he is supposed to inherit it. See, this is why I can't do plot. I just, like, plot doesn't... It's hard for me to connect the dots for me to even explain it. You know what I mean?
It's a Marvel movie, right? So, I mean, like, we can explain the plot. I've never seen the movie, but I can explain the plot really quickly. Dude doesn't have a whole lot of power, has a fun friend, gets power. As it turns out, the villain is someone close to him in some way, shape, or form, and it causes strife and emotional issues. But in the end, he manages to win and gain more power. But something else happens that connects it to a movie that's going to come out later. Is that pretty much it?
Yes.
Okay, perfect.
That's interesting because it is nice that we have movies that do the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I'm acting like an asshole. I really like Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which literally has the exact same plot. I mean, that's literally the plot of Guardians of the Galaxy 2. And I really like that movie. It actually makes me cry every time I watch it, and I don't feel that way about any other Marvel movies. But in the end, when Yondu is, like, let out of the ship, and, like, his friends who, like, banished him because they thought he was a bad guy, but he shows to be a good guy in the end, are, like, there and are like, he deserves a warrior's funeral. I'm like, oh, I have a dad, and one day he's going to be dead. Oh, no. Oh, and I start feeling sad and crying.
When I said Marvel films do the same thing over and over again, and that's, like, kind of nice, I don't mean that as a joke. I do think there's something very meaningful about taking a similar plot and moving into different contexts and allowing people from those different contexts to feel more connected to one or the other.
Do you like Marvel movies, Cheryl? Do you have a favorite superhero flick?
Well, I'm not a Marvel fan in that I'll watch every Marvel film that comes out. I haven't really seen that much of it. But Shang-Chi, I think, I don't remember if I cried when I saw it in the cinema, but I think I did. And there was something different about this one that isn't just because of Asian representation or anything. But, like, I thought that the actor who played the dad, Tony Leung, he's, like, a fucking iconic Hong Kong actor. And it was, like, really touching that he, you know, he's, like, out in Hollywood doing all this shit. And he's, I think his rendering of the dad was so human. And I think all the characters in this film were so humanized and that they were flawed. And you could see that, like, even the villain, it came from, like, his actions came from a place of pain and love, actually, just a bad way to show it. I don't know. I just thought the film was so humanizing, and it felt more layered and, like, multidimensional than a lot of other Marvel films that I felt like were so binary. Like, you're either good or bad, and you either are trying to, you know, kill someone or save someone. But this felt so, like, every character had so much internal conflict, and you could really feel it from the acting. And I thought, yeah, I don't know, I fuck with this movie. I think it's good.
Except Awkwafina, her internal conflict is not that serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to say that that's exactly what I wanted to move on to, because Cheryl, you mentioned is that you don't think it's just because of the Asian American stuff or the Asian stuff. But I am a little curious about exploring that a little deeper.
Let's go.
In order to set that context, Suede, so when Black Panther came out, there was a huge amount of discourse. I kind of feel like Shang-Chi didn't receive that discourse in the same way. Do you think it was just because of COVID? Because I wasn't living in America when this film was released, so that's why I don't remember or know. You weren't in America either, right, Cheryl?
I was not. I was here.
Did you feel that the discourse was, like, different, though, right?
I did feel that from the internet.
I think the discourse is different. Also, I think the main actor who was in Kim's Convenience and whose name is currently eluding me said something.
Oh, Simu. I mean, he was also working with, like, Mark Wahlberg, and I think he previously, like, shat on him. So there was some, but I think that was after Shang-Chi came out.
The actor Shang-Chi has a bit of controversy, you guys.
Yeah, said, and gotcha, I can't remember gotcha. What it was.
I was a little surprised Asian Americans weren't able to jump on board on this film and bring out a type of interesting Asian narrative out of it. Because, I don't know, the character Tony Leung plays, yes, my dad has never gone and tried to kill a whole society by unleashing an evil demon just to save my mom. But sometimes I think my dad's thinking of what love is not that far off. I think there's sometimes my dad gets to this point where he thinks responsibility is so important to defining what love is, he lets that type of responsibility overcome what Americans or what we want to call healthy love. And when that happens, that makes the son's relationship really complicated because he also feels that type of responsibility, but also gets the full brunt of the toxic responsibility. And then Shang-Chi's sister, also a character that I fucking love, because she has to deal with having the neglect of the responsibility, but also not being able to be a little free of without that masculine toxic responsibility too. That's why I was surprised that you don't think it's like very centered into Asianness.
What I meant was that I don't love this movie just because it's an Asian cast. That's all I meant.
Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting because that kind of goes back to what we were saying about Come On. The familial relationships in Shang-Chi are treated so differently than the innocence that we allow for that child in Come On. Just love is so different traditionally in Asia. I think the way it's shown or expected, I think it's changed throughout the generations with the internet and with, essentially with the internet. It's almost like love is becoming globalized and homogenized in a sense.
Oh, that's awesome. That's cool.
I don't know. I don't know if that's cool. As in, I don't know. I don't know if it's a good thing because I think it's good that because of the internet, we can all learn what healthy love is and we can learn that you should have boundaries and you should have expectations and that you deserve to be loved, you know, all that. But, you know, in Asia, especially in families, the way you show love is, how would I describe it? It's kind of more...
It's acts of service, right?
I mean, that's a Western term.
And I'm just going with the five love languages, classic piece of literature, five love languages.
I think in Asia, it's so strict and extreme, but I don't mean strict in the like Western gaze way, like, oh, Asia's so strict, but I think... So, like, I'll do anything, and, like, just because I yell at you doesn't mean that, like, it's clear, like, can't you see that I love you? Yeah, I'm yelling at you, but bought you, like, a million bags of chips, like, it's so obvious that I love you, but, you know, in the West, it would be like, what the fuck, like, you're, this is, like, love bombing, and you're being selfish, and you think just because you intend something that it's received that way, but in Asia... Like if you prove yourself that you would go out of your way to do something, that's all that is. It's just sacrifice. Love is sacrifice in Asia, and I think in the West it's so much more about communication and, you know, it's reciprocal.
I think that's really interesting because there's this narrative that gets presented in the West that's like that is being a very negative thing, right? Like that the relationship between families and all the like family drama movies are like, you don't see how much I sacrificed for you, son. I used to wake up at 4 in the morning to go to my job, and then the kid's like, all I wanted you to do was play catch with me. I didn't need all the things, yeah. Right? I mean, that totally is the opposite. And the reason I said it's cool when you said what love is being globalized, I don't think that love is being globalized is cool. I think you're right that it's maybe a great idea. But I had forgotten how complex love is because I feel it so much.
Can I talk about my favorite scene that embraces Tony Leung's great acting and the love that we're talking about?
Yeah. Go.
So basically Shang-Chi runs to fucking America, the great land of love, because his dad beat him to get good at martial arts all the time. And basically, by the way, family dynamics, the mom dies and gets killed, and the dad always wants to get revenge.
Revenge on who?
I forget exactly. So basically, the mom's also originally, like, a fucking fantastic, like, they're, like, the best at martial arts or whatever school they're in. And then they get married, and I think the mom, does she stop doing martial arts for the kids or
she
something?
She loses her powers.
She loses her, because she gets married?
Because she leaves the village.
I see. So she goes to his village, and because of that, she loses her powers. I don't know who it was, but basically the mom's at home with the kids, and then some people come and burn down the dad's village. They try to, but in doing so, they kill the mom as well. So the dad's a villain because actually he wants to take revenge. It really is because of loss and grief.
So there's all this buildup about like him running away, how he's scared. He meets his sister before he goes to his dad, and his sister and him have drama that they kind of talk out, but not really get resolved. Because by the whole time, they're being chased by his dad's minions as if they're like coming out to capture you and fuck you up. And finally, they get a chance to meet the big boss, Tony Leung. And you're like kind of anticipating what the fuck is going to, is he going to be mad? Are they going to jail immediately? So Shang-Chi comes in and Tony Leung looks up. That scene of like love, I don't know. It's like that whole movie for Shang-Chi, all he was thinking about was about his dad's abuse. But because Tony Leung looks at him with such a connection and almost as if Tony Leung doesn't even recognize all the abuse he did to Shang-Chi. Shang-Chi has a hard time not forgiving that. And my dad does that to me all the fucking time. There are so many moments where I'm so fucking angry at him for doing some really shitty things. And he's never gonna recognize it. But sometimes he just does these acts or stuff that's like so obviously that like he loves me. I almost can't even hold on to all that baggage of stuff that I'm upset about.
Don't you think that well, essentially that's like forgiveness, right? It's like that moment summons your forgiveness for him because like precisely because you know that he doesn't recognize what he's doing. Like if he did, you would be more like, dude, you know you're hurting me and you're still doing it. But it's the unawareness that makes it forgivable, which is not, I don't know if that's good. Surely in a translated into a toxic relationship, that's not good. Like it shouldn't always warrant forgiveness.
Do you think there's a difference between forgiveness and love, right? You know, that maybe it's worth acknowledging the fact that you can love someone despite the things they've done. You can love them without forgiving them, right? I mean, that those two things can be held in the hand at the same time, that it's not like either you love someone or you're angry at them. More often than not, it's like it's full of tied knots.
I don't think it's mutually exclusive, but I think that forgiveness is in the net of, it's a tied knot, but it's in the net. Like I think forgiveness is inside of the net of love. And I think if you forgive someone, it's because you are putting yourself in their shoes, and you can only do that if you have the capacity to love someone and the potential to forgive them.
For me, the term forgiveness is an interesting term. One, forgiveness feels a little too long. You forgive someone and it's like done. You did it.
Yeah, it's a permanent.
Yeah, it feels very permanent and grand.
And number two, I actually think the act of forgiveness is very active. So like, I forgive you. But dude, sometimes when my dad or like when Tony Leung gave those eyes to Shang-Chi.
My dad, Tony Leung.
I don't think. So when Tony Leung gave those eyes to Shang-Chi, I don't think Shang-Chi had any control over forgiving his dad. And it's almost like your sense of agency completely collapses onto the understanding of the family structure of love.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's hard to explain, because agency is so important in emotional control in different civilizations. But I think you feel an emotion because your agency is stripped away from you. The emotion comes because your identity is taken away.
I think in modern psychology, in this era of like healthy love and communication and self-care in the West, I think what all of that comes from, this American sense of wanting agency over your emotions. Like we're learning how to communicate our love because we want agency. We want labels like I'm feeling this way, and communication, I mean, it's just words. And I think in Asia, there's less of that agency. We don't have agency of that because we've never learned, because it's still taboo to, you know, admit that you're hurt, in Hong Kong, at least. Because of that, forgiveness in Asia is not active, I think, less so. If you were to tally it, there's probably less moments of like, you know what? I understand that this person did this to me because of this, and therefore I forgive them. It's more instinctual and like primitive in a way. Like that moment you were saying, it's an act of empathy, but we don't have the words for it. We're not going to break it down and be like, this happened. It's just a feeling.
Cheryl, is there a personal story about your dad that you wanted to share? I realize I didn't ask you for any of it.
This isn't a specific story, but I think on my dad's side of the family, the way my aunts and my dad are brought up to express love is through like excessive generosity with like buying food. There's something so sad about that. Sad in like a nice way. Just it's so innocent almost. It's like a child, like this like really stubborn, I'm gonna buy all of it kind of, just the stubbornness of it I think is really touching, I guess. There's like a childlike ignorance to not knowing how to express something but wanting it so bad, and you're doing it wrong, but it's so obvious that you want the other person to feel that you feel this way about them. And I think that's the kind of like childlike naivety that I think is so powerful in literature and movies and all that, that I think Come On, Come On didn't really, there was no desperation in that movie from the child's perspective that I think I wanted to see.
I'm glad that you also cried to Shang-Chi, because dude, there was something about coming out of that movie that I was like, I know this is a Marvel movie and I know these feelings are a little like simplified, but what the fuck?
Yeah.
I am connecting to this movie on some fucking deep personal level.
That's what these Marvel movies are good at. They're so good at like finding that like one little spot in your armor and just poking at it, right? And that's why there are so many that are so popular, right?
No matter how pretentious it gets, no matter how, from now on, I'm never ever going to bring another major movie and I'm only doing art house experimental movies from now on. Just remember, I do care about these movies. They struggle to explain concepts that actually don't have words for, but they try to do it in such a fucking mega repetition to such a wide audience. There has to be something there.
Do you think it's less exploration and more presentation, right? So like Guardians of the Galaxy, they don't explain the anxiety of loss. They just show it. You're like, look at this. Isn't this sad? Isn't this something you can connect with? They present Guardians of the Galaxy, Shang-Chi, Call of Duty Winter Soldier, Batman.
Call of Duty Winter Soldier.
Yeah. Fucking Captain Amazing.
Michael Jordan and the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Michael Jordan, Catboy. The Incredible Shrinking Woman. Yeah. Special shout out to Sid Sejo.
Shout out to you. You were our first comment
on iTunes. They write, this is quite literally one of the greatest film podcasts I've ever listened to. I've learned so much about film and the hosts are so funny and insightful.
Yeah, I think they're just talking about me.
I was going to assume that they'd never even listened to the podcast before, but you want to say you are both insightful and funny?
No, I just want to say I am the host and you are a hoe.
I'm a hoe. I'm a hoe.
We're actually really, really happy. I'm not gonna lie. I kind of teared up out of sadness that I was so lonely, that we'll never meet, and that we're not friends.
Hey, you know what? We might not never meet. Shoot us an email at fakefilmfans.com and give us a shout out. Maybe we'll get you on the podcast. Don't forget, we got to get to 50 five-star reviews for the belly slap of destructive proportions. I actually hung out with my buddy Austin, who was on the podcast like 2 days ago, and he looked me dead in the eye and he's like, I'm gonna slap your stomach so fucking hard. And I was like, oh no, because Slough's a big dude. He's like at least 6'2" with like big meaty Irish hands, and you know, I was thinking about Celine slapping me, and that's nothing. She's got tiny dainty little painter hands. But
I want a name for this sub goal. Do you think slap a belly turned home is a good name?
That's the worst thing I've ever heard. Fucking, I want to come to slap.
You are so good at making names. Go ahead.
Gonna say 50-star slapathon, or no, wait, 55-star slapathon, because the amount of stars would be 55, right? So we're doing this. It's a 55-star slapathon.
Cheryl, you were talking about that food thing. Do you want to shout out that fucking article you wrote about your dad buying you food?
Or which one?
Is that too vulnerable?
Okay. So everyone who's listening, you want to read my, I wrote this thing that was in some thing on the internet. If you want to read, it's kind of about food as love, which is such a cliche topic, honestly.
We'll tweet it, so check out our Twitter. We'll post a link to where you can read it.
My Twitter is CEHRYL. I tweet dumb shit. Follow me.
Alrighty, perfect. Yeah, I think we tackled a lot. We tackle a lot every episode. We're probably gonna go back to the original format of Walter watching 4.5-hour long movies of just like shifting colors and me watching movies with like swords and boobs.
We're just better at that. That's just what we are.
I mean, let's say I'm the common man. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Cheryl, Walt. I love you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we'll get you on again. I think the only thing left to say is if you're gonna watch a movie,
do it with the lights off.